Before we begin, I want to quickly announce that our patron-exclusive episode on the Pirates of the Caribbean is now live. To listen to the episode, head to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon, where you can also vote for what movie we should cover in our June patron-exclusive episode. Link in the show notes. Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about Captain America: Civil War, the 2016 film, screenplay by Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, directed by Anthony and Joe Russo. I'm here with the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And Alex Cayetos.
Hello.
So we're talking about Civil War to tie into the video that we just released that tracks the character arcs of Iron Man and Captain America across the whole MCU, the 11-year saga that happened. And this idea came from you, Brian. So do you want to talk about how this idea came to you and why you thought it'd be a good video?
Yeah, definitely. I've had this idea for a year. It was like a note in my phone that I took while listening to Marcus and McFeely, the screenwriters, on a podcast. They were talking about the arcs of Steve and Tony. And the two quotes that really stuck with me, I'm very glad made it into the video, which are that their arcs clash in the middle when Tony becomes more, you know, selfless and Steve becomes a little more self-interested. And that at the end, their paths are complete when Tony sacrifices his life and Steve gets a life. And I was just like, ooh, that's great. And then suddenly I just saw the entire MCU in front of me and just thinking about three phases, three acts. Technically, Civil War is at the beginning of the third phase, but if you know, in terms of like the big ensemble movies, it's the middle of five, and it just sort of felt like really nice and clean. And then rewatching it to start working on it, I just realized how much, you know, you never know quite when they start figuring out, oh, here's what we're going to do two movies from now, or here's what, but how many times in Avengers and Age of Ultron, like either Tony or Steve state their beliefs and it's while arguing with the other one. And I just thought, oh, it's so cool that it just, when you watch it all together, it just feels like this full thing that was planned from the beginning, which in some regards it was. I'm sure they knew at some point we'll probably get to do Civil War. So let's sort of plant those seeds now, even if we haven't quite figured out when that's going to happen. Finally, we started talking about it and then we were able to come up with the video, just sort of tracking the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, you know, journey that they both go on.
I immediately got excited about it just because it's a fun idea, but also because I think it is highlighting the thing that I find the most impressive about the MCU is that these two characters do have this great arc. And I'm glad that we're talking about Civil War, the film in particular, because I've realized that that's, I think, when I got into the MCU.
Uh-huh. Mm.
Like, I think up to that point, I was going out of curiosity / obligation. And Civil War, I went and saw and walked away and was like, wait, that was really fun. There were some interesting ideas. And so that, I think, marked a turning point for me in my personal journey with the MCU. And I feel like that also, it seems to me that's when they started to really figure out, okay, and now we know where we're going, because the things that get set up seem like they have a very clear trajectory. But yeah, I'm curious, Alex, I know you have a complicated relationship with the MCU, shall we say. What's your impression of Civil War?
It's amazing because my experience is the exact opposite of yours. Civil War is where I was like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Because I think it was just like, it's honestly where Marvel started to lose me, because I think it was the first, you know, I don't know if I had seen every single Marvel movie up until Civil War. I think I'd missed Ant-Man.
I'll help you out. You hadn't. Yeah.
I had.
There's no chance you had.
I'm sure I hadn't. Yeah, because I'm not sure where in the spectrum it falls timeline wise. But I mean, I saw all the early ones. I saw all the Iron Mans and the Captain Americas and Thor and I enjoyed those movies generally. And I think part of why I liked them was that they still seemed to function as individual movies. So I could go to a movie theater and sit down and like enjoy this film. Yeah, there's Samuel L. Jackson at the end, you know, saying a one-liner after the credits, and like, oh, what's that? Okay, whatever. But like the movie itself felt like a movie, and I like could enjoy it, and I didn't have to like be deeply, deeply invested in like 20 characters to like enjoy this one movie. And Civil War, it was the first time where Marvel began to feel like this movie in and of itself doesn't seem to have like an internal reason to exist. It's just this like product in a larger continuum of products and symbols. And it's like a connective glue that is like establishing like products to come and like bringing in like the symbols from the past products. And it's like a nexus of products, but it doesn't feel to me like a movie. It doesn't feel to me like I'm so happy I went to a theater and sat down and watched this movie, because like when I'm watching this movie, I feel unmoored. I don't feel like, I don't know where I am. I know that like there are characters from 5 movies ago that I'm supposed to remember why I'm supposed to care about them. I know there's characters being set up in this movie that don't seem to really matter in this movie, but like will matter later. And I don't know what is contained within the boundaries of this movie that actually is of consequence.
Well, my question then is, so now that you've seen where it all goes, so like, I think you're wrong, but I think that like, I think that you maybe weren't the only one to feel that way going to see it, you know, especially as an adult, right? So like, we are kind of the audience for this, but we're maybe not the primary audience for this entire franchise. So I get that. But now that you've seen where it all goes and you see where Civil War falls in this amazing, like, very, very long saga, has that changed how you feel about it?
Definitely revisiting it, I was really impressed with the Black Panther setup. Like, that was cool. Like, there was some stuff where I was like, that's interesting. Like, they really had a plan and they were setting up, you know, things that I'm going to care about more later. That said, like, I really enjoyed Endgame because it like had an ending and it was a movie with stakes, and like it had, you know, it was able to function as a movie. Like Endgame has like an opening, like a cold open that is like riveting, and it has a conclusion that is emotional. And I feel like these in-between movies, like, I don't enjoy them on their own, honestly. Like, I enjoy them in theory. Like, I enjoy them as like ideas, like, as once again, like how impressive it is that like this franchise was managed so well so that things could be like woven together. But like, I watched it again after having done this Marvel video, which I will say like really upped my appreciation for the franchise. Like, working on this Captain America vs. Iron Man video, I was really wowed by the fact that they had built such a perfect arc for the two characters. So I went back into Civil War to rewatch it this last week, ready to like it more. And it was hard for me to get through. I was tuning out. I was just kind of like soul sick by the end of it.
Do you hear that? Do you hear our listeners screaming at you in their cars?
Bring it on.
Or wherever they are?
Bring it on.
Or screaming in celebration.
I gave it another chance. I went into it wanting to love it.
So I think you're entirely right. And the writer and directors have said that this was the first movie where it's not self-contained, where they leaned into the idea of like, at this point, we're going to expect you to have been invested in this. So it isn't a standalone.
At least a working knowledge. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's not a standalone movie that allows it to be something else where they don't have to spend the first, you know, third of the movie setting up all this stuff. It can just be, okay, and now like we're going to pick up where we were, and it lets it become kind of what the Marvel films ultimately became, and allowed them to set up things like Endgame. It was interesting because thinking back, this was, as I said, the movie that I got really excited and really into. Like, I liked some of the earlier ones also, but this was the one where I was like, oh, this is actually really fun seeing them all fight each other. And like that, you know, the airplane or the airport fight scene is just, we can talk about it, is just fun from top to bottom. But revisiting it, I was less impressed with it this time around. And I think for me, it's because Infinity War and then Endgame were so impressive and like stuck the landing so well that going back a little bit, I was reminded a little bit of how what you're talking about, Alex, that I also felt a little bit of this, like it wasn't quite firing on all cylinders and felt a little bit like the filler that's required versus the satisfaction of the 1-2 of Infinity War and Endgame.
I don't even know where to start with you two. Like, Michael, this is the midpoint of the series. Midpoints are your favorite thing in the whole world. That's why I said
I love it.
It's a great one. Alex, yeah. You love long form storytelling and television shows. And that's
and crunchy
this is.
Action.
Like, and that's when this shifted from like a bunch of disconnected superhero nonsense into like a real long form storytelling thing.
I guess,
do I have to sell this movie to you guys? It's so cool. It's not even about like world ending stakes. It's like the stakes are so much smaller. It's about the relationships between the characters. I think that there's like such compelling human drama at the heart of this. And what is happening? I don't know. Brian, talk some sense to them.
Oh, I'll just say like, I understand that. I'm like, I think once again, in theory, I should like this movie. And in theory, it should be like the point where, yeah, like I got more engaged because it's like how cool they're building this like ongoing story. I just don't care about the story and I don't care about the characters. Like it never won me over that way. Like I feel like I'm watching things happen because they have to happen to get to the next thing, but not because I'm enjoying them while they're happening. Like that's, I have a feeling of like almost, it's like the obligation thing you mentioned, Michael. It's like, we are all obligated to watch the Marvel movies because there's going to be more after this. And you're going to have to watch this one to know what the hell is going on in this one. And so it's like, I'm doing this out of my duty to Marvel, but like within the 2.5 hours of watching this movie, I'm not like deriving that much pleasure from it. Like it's a duty to like get to the next one.
Captain America pulls down a helicopter with his muscles. I don't know what else you want. Like,
I mean, I'm fine with that.
And I do like that in the commentary, the writer and directors were sort of like, LOL, we did that. Like, they're aware of how like goofy and fun it is.
Marcus and McFeely, like, I do appreciate that they really are sort of happy to be self-referential and kind of make fun of themselves. And I think that helps. You know, it's like we were saying, like, this is our Scott Pilgrim episode. It's like, as soon as you have Anna Kendrick going, like, what? It's like, okay, we're all in this together. Like, right. you have Spider-Man saying, you know, that thing does not obey the law of physics at all. Or Sam says, like, everyone has a gimmick these days. You know, like, they said on the Endgame podcast, they're like, yeah, we had originally in the time heist, like 5 minutes of self-referential jokes that was just kind of like before Kevin Feige walked in and looked at it was like, guys, what are you doing? Like, relax a little bit. But I do appreciate that because it shows like we're not taking this too seriously, even though we are treating it in a serious way. And I think I really like that balance.
Yeah. Well, and listening to the commentary for the movie, one of the like best screenwriting lessons I feel like they talked about was how they balanced the tone of this movie, because it swings wildly. Like there are very dark moments.
Pretty intense swings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of saying that, you know, they wanted the main characters that are directly involved with the Accords and making the choices. So, you know, Tony and Steve and Tasha and T'Challa, they're all like serious for the most part. They have to be committed to the thing because this is a very serious thing for them. But in order to keep the movie fun, they allowed themselves to bring in those characters like Ant-Man and Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And all of the laughs are given to the people that are not emotionally invested in the same way.
I'm shaking your hand too long. Captain America, I know you too. You're great.
Right. And so they were saying, it's not by accident that those people have the fun moments because they're the people that can have the fun moments without jeopardizing the gravity of the actual drama.
And they start it like right out of the gate, especially with Tony's character, because he isn't in that opening sequence where they're, you know, it's like Natasha and Scarlet Witch is there and they're going up against, I'm sorry, what is the name of that cross? What is that guy's name? Crossbones?
Crossbones.
Yeah. Angry Punch Man.
Right. But Iron Man is not in that sequence, which I think is a really interesting decision because he is going to become such a huge part of this movie. They let that sort of like be over there. And it dramatically, the effect of that sequence is mostly on Wanda, even though you could see it potentially could impact Cap as well. But then they let the holdover from the Sokovia Accords come back in. So when we first see Tony in this movie, you have this really dramatic opening scene with his parents in this simulation where he's like, I wish it would have gone that way. it's such a 180 from how we're used to seeing Tony, right? Like, he's not flippant at all. And then when he's confronted by this grieving mother, which to me is like one of the best scenes in the entire MCU, or one of the most grounding scenes in the entire MCU, that's where we open with Tony. And I think it's a really smart decision to start off that way. And again, it gives it that gravity that it absolutely has to have for these like inter-character moments to actually have weight.
Yeah, I mean, you have sort of these two characters who are kind of dealing with the same idea, but in these two very different ways, because Wanda basically has the same thing that Tony has, which is like, I was responsible for deaths and I am very guilty about it, but they have different responses, which hers is like, let's get out of town, you know, and Tony's is like, let's just put ourselves in check. And I think that, like, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of just weight in this movie with like Bucky killing Tony's parents and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But the moment that stuck out to me this time was when Sharon Carter is giving Peggy's like eulogy.
Yeah.
She says, you know, oh, Peggy always told me, don't budge, like compromise when you have to, but don't budge if you don't believe in something. And the interesting thing is Cap could take that either way.
Right.
He could take that and say, well, compromise when you have to, but he could also say, if you don't believe in it, don't budge. And he chooses to take it the way he takes it, you know? And I just think it's really cool that you see these characters dealing with the same kind of theme or different takes on the theme, and they're kind of both right and they're kind of both wrong, you know, and it's just that because they choose the sides they choose, then it ends up causing this conflict, obviously.
And I feel like they're able to walk that line really well, where you get where both of them are coming from. Like, I think for me, a little bit the like the setups of it and like the reasonings behind where they're coming from, some doesn't connect as much as other things, but where they actually are in regards to the Sokovia Accords, I feel like is kind of what you're looking for, where you can see both sides. You can see why Tony would be like, we need to be kept in check. Like, oversight of some kind is good. This is maybe too extreme, but maybe it's better than nothing.
Right.
But you also understand, you know, even from the Marvel history, why putting trust in organizations of power has like been terrible.
Not worked out. Yeah.
Not worked out. And so I feel like that's what drew me in, is they really find this balance in a compelling way for me.
Exactly.
Hello, listener. So Trisha has watched a movie on Mubi. And Mubi, if you don't know, is a curated streaming service showing exceptional handpicked films from around the globe. Trisha, what did you watch?
I watched The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, which is actually a movie I'd been meaning to see already. It's from 1946. It's a wonderful film noir starring Barbara Stanwyck, Van Heflin, super young Kirk Douglas, and Elizabeth Scott, who I really, really love. I know. It's a really fascinating movie. It's by a Ukrainian filmmaker named Louis Milestone.
That's not a real name. No way.
It's about this. It's a love triangle. And it opens with these three characters that are in like a small town, essentially, in the rural United States during the Depression. And there's like, they're kind of all caught up in this murder. And so they have this secret. And that's kind of like a prologue. And then the rest of the movie is about them as adults and like this love triangle that develops and how it all kind of spirals out from there with like blackmail and like intrigue. And Kirk Douglas plays like the DA in the town, but he's a crazy alcoholic and really unhinged. And it's awesome. I had a really good time watching it, but there's a lot of good stuff on Mubi right now. So it was almost even hard to choose this one, because Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is on there right now, which is so good if you haven't seen it. And Dawson City Frozen Time, which is a crazy documentary about like film that was actually frozen in ice in this. Yeah, and they pulled it out and they like processed it. And anyway, there's lots of great stuff on there right now, but also The Strange Love of Martha Ivers.
Awesome. That does sound cool. I like a good twisty noir. Awesome. Well, so listener, if you want to check out The Strange Love of Martha Ivers or any of the other unique selections on Mubi, you can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. In doing so, you'll be helping to support the show and getting to watch a twisty noir from 1954?
46.
46. Same thing. Thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, a lot of my complaints with this movie have to do with just the overall thing that it is. But there's a lot in this movie I do like. You know, I actually really like a lot of this first half of the film, where there is a lot of time just spent on kind of grappling with the reality of, we have this universe with a group of like superhuman, extra powerful people.
Enhanced
people that can basically do whatever they want. And that's kind of terrifying. And you know, I know like the DC movies kind of deal with the same idea. You know, it's kind of became a cross-platform theme.
You don't need to throw the DCU a bone, for the record.
Right.
No need.
Didn't DC kind of do it first as far as like the Superman versus Batman?
I think they came out around the same time. I mean, the conflict has been like, you know, in the comics for forever.
It's not a new idea.
But it was around this time that the movies, and this is again the things that the creators talk about, that the movies became aware of how audiences were perceiving, you know, the destruction and all of the, you know, at the end of every movie, a city has been demolished and probably like millions of innocent people were killed.
Right.
I feel like the DC universe like leaned into that much harder, I think, than the MCU a little bit.
Right.
It's a subjective opinion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, The Incredibles did that first, because the entire like setup of The Incredibles is like, hey, superheroes are causing a lot of trouble. Let's make them basically illegal.
Right. Exactly.
But I genuinely was interested in that conflict. And I did find it to be interesting. And I think part of where the movie loses me is, and I've mentioned this on other podcasts, is the Bucky factor. Because because I was watching it again, and I understand this time. I understand that, like, you know, Bucky was mind controlled. He's been a victim. Like, Steve's loyal to his old time friends from way back in the day. But I think that's part of, you know, when I was talking about the, like, the disconnection you feel sometimes plopped into the middle of the story, because they're not worrying about setting up like, what was Bucky before he was the Winter Soldier? Like, what was his relationship with Steve before Steve just took pity on this guy who's brainwashed? Like, we don't have any of that in this movie, honestly, except for some throwaway lines about like childhood in Brooklyn near the end. And I think that's the kind of thing where it's like, if the emotional catalyst for Captain America to swing really hard against Iron Man is going to be this guy who's been like framed for this crime, then I do want, within this movie, within this product, a little bit more of understanding of like what their relationship is.
Stop lobbing the word product at this movie like it's a slur. Like, honestly, Alex, this is a movie. It is a film, some might say. You can engage it on that level. Sorry, Brian, go ahead. What were you going to say?
This movie does certainly require the first two Captain America movies to be pretty fresh in your head. Like, you know, Crossbones is not like the most interesting character ever. And, you know, but it's like, you have to have just watched Winter Soldier to have him be like, you again or whatever. And it's like, oh, okay, right. You know, I like vaguely remember you. Bucky is obviously like, he's a huge deal in both the first two movies. So if you have a working knowledge, you're going to remember them at least. But yeah, it definitely, I mean, that is, on our MCU podcast, we talked about how the movies feel like these episodic things sometimes. Like, I saw the very first Iron Man, the first movie, I just thought like, oh, that didn't quite feel like a full thing. It felt like part of something. And then now, 11 years later, I'm able to look at it with a bird's eye view and be like, oh, this is really cool. I actually felt the same way watching The Mandalorian, where I was so frustrated that each episode was just a kind of standalone thing. And then episodes 7 and 8 were finally like, now we're bringing it all together. And I was like, cool, I wish you had done that a little sooner. But it was very satisfying to watch those last two episodes, the way like watching Endgame is like, here's everything coming together. I think what the Russos did for the MCU is kind of what Alfonso Cuarón and then later David Yates did for Harry Potter, or like what J.J. Abrams did for Mission Impossible, which is like, they brought this sort of groundedness to it. You know, you watch Winter Soldier, and I'm not like the biggest political thriller fan. So watching Winter Soldier or even Civil War the first time, I was like, okay, like, I'm not really following these, like, and then there's this, and this guy is pretending to be this guy or whatever. I'm like, okay. But when the action scenes happen, I'm just really appreciating that they are, as you would say, Alex, crunchy. Like, there is this like very grounded sense to them. Like, there's one moment in Civil War where Bucky grabs the motorcycle and it goes like, boosh, and it's like slows down. And I'm like, that just feels out of place, because the rest of the movie feels pretty grounded and sort of gritty with the way it handles the action. And I appreciate that because I think they set a new tone for the MCU. Captain America, the First Avenger, was directed by the guy who directed The Rocketeer, and it feels like it.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's sort of really goofy. And, you know, I think, as you said, Trisha, when you were rewatching it, like, nothing in here is real.
It really is not.
but the thing I appreciate about Civil War II is that, like, it doesn't feel like this one episode. I know what you're saying, Alex. It feels like they're set up for the future and there's stuff you need to know from the past. But in terms of the structure of a movie, it feels like three movies in one. It's like every act has, like, builds to this climax and it keeps going. And I feel like that's what I want from this kind of movie, as opposed to some of the other MCU movies, which feel like, oh, here's a guy, here's a bad guy, got the bad guy, okay, like, next movie. So that's one thing I do appreciate about Civil War, is it feels grounded and weighty, for as, like, kind of silly as it gets. It's like, now there's an Ant-Man is, like, throwing things at people and that kind of thing, but it just feels like this, like, nice complete movie that is, like, very ambitious.
I agree, and I want to highlight something here that I really, really appreciate from the screenwriters and from the directors, because, Alex, the Bucky problem that you are describing is a real problem, right? We called it out.
It's a real problem.
It's a real problem. We talked about it in our other podcast about the MCU on Infinity War and Endgame. And, you know, you have this character who kind of needs to be a plot device, but he also has to be a person. Right. And I think we can definitely argue about the extent to which he feels more like one or the other in a potentially negative way. But I will say that, to the screenwriter, to Marcus and McFeely's credit here, they seem to understand that they're going to need to do some kind of grounding work for the character in this movie. Because, unfortunately, the thing about a brainwashed character is that brainwashing robs them of their agency. That's the whole point. Right. We don't have, as you were saying, Alex, a really good sense of who Bucky was before he became the Winter Soldier. And we need to, in order to get on board with why he's important to Cap. So I think the critical scene in this, in terms of that, like, storyline, is the one where he's starting to have memories again of Cap. And so when Cap goes to find him and bring him in himself, and they're in that apartment, the, like, little crappy apartment, and Cap, and they go and they look at each other in the face, they're in the room together, and he's starting to say, like, I remember this about you, I remember that about you. Whether or not it worked for you personally, Alex, to the screenwriter's credit, they understand, we have to have this scene. We have to actually, like, imbue these two characters with some relationship, some sense of stakes, so we know why we're going to care about Bucky for the rest of this movie. The other sequence that I really like in terms of character work is when Bucky gets loose after he has been brainwashed and everybody has to fight him without any of their gear or, like, tools or weapons
that's a cool
sequence.
The look on Tony's face when he, like, shoots the gun, and the only reason he didn't just get his head blown off is because he had his iron hand over it. He's just
I feel like that's the only time we see him fight without a suit. Or at least that's the only one I can remember.
There's a moment in Endgame where he gets smashed by the Hulk and he doesn't have his suit on. And he's, like, knocked unconscious, you know, like, as he would be. But
yeah,
I do want to say that the car chase, like, action scene in Winter Soldier is maybe one of my favorite action scenes of, like, recent years.
It's a cool one.
Like, that was a really, that's when the Russos did that movie. And I was like, who's directing this? This is, like, way better than I would expect for just, like, another entry in this franchise. So, yeah, I mean, definitely there's a craft to some of the action that these guys do that is, like, really remarkable.
Yes, absolutely.
And I feel like, for me, I agree with Alex to the extent that I'm never invested in Bucky either. Like, Bucky has a line where he says, I don't know if I'm worth all this, Steve. And every time I watch it, I'm like, you are correct.
But you're definitely not worth all this. Like, this is not worth it.
But I do feel like,
Stan.
Well, and I was going to say, I think the performances of everybody, like, make me believe it enough to, like, go along with it. And I feel like that's another thing that the MCU should be praised for, is, like, all the actors, like, come to play.
Yeah. Right.
Like, they deliver, and Chris Evans, and it's cool hearing about how they, you know, Robert Downey Jr. wasn't contracted to do this movie because it was just going to be, you know, another Captain America movie originally.
Right.
And so they had to go to him and, like, convince him to do this. And so they sort of had to explain, like, this is going to be a new Tony, like he's going to evolve. There's going to be these other things happening. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what got Robert Downey Jr. excited about it. And I feel like that's, you can feel that, like, there's actual, like, dramatic character changes happening and they're delivering on it and taking it 100% seriously, mm-hmm. which I think is what pulls you in.
The moment I can't get over is Robert Downey Jr.'s performance when he says, "I don't care, he killed my mom."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That always stood out to me.
Ugh.
Yeah.
It's so devastating. And you buy it. You're like, all of the logic aside, we are going to have this fight scene because it's about something personal to the character.
Right. I'd forgotten about that twist. Rewatching mm-hmm. it, and because I was like, how are they going to end up all fighting each other by the end of this movie? Because I know there's like the cool shot where all three of them are fighting, and then that twist happened. I'm like, oh, that's right, that's a good mm-hmm. twist.
That shot, by the way, like, they put too much in the trailer for this movie, because that shot where it's the wide shot of the three of them and uh-huh. Bucky throws the shield and then they just start fighting. And just like that, and putting Spider-Man in the trailer and everything, I was like, I would have been a lot more excited watching this movie if I didn't know any of that was coming.
Yeah.
There is an element, though, where I watch these movies, and because I'm not, like, I still consider myself a casual Marvel fan, even though I have, like, seen all the movies, and I enjoyed them, and I've seen them multiple times and stuff. I'm still not, like, the, like, crazy fanboy, partially just because of, like, the age I was when this whole thing started.
Right.
But, like, sure. I can genuinely get excited for people 10 years younger than me. Like, there are moments mm-hmm. where I get like emotional, not even personally, I'm like getting like emotional by proxy for the person who was, you know, 10 when Iron Man came out, and then at 21 is now watching this whole thing like finally finish. I'm just like, I'm so excited for you.
You can go see them with kids. It'll give you that for sure.
Right. Like, we talked about that a little bit in our episode. We're like mm-hmm. sitting next to children I thought was going to be super annoying during Infinity War, and then seeing their minds be blown, like transferred their energy into me. It was amazing.
You sucked their energy like Rogue from X-Men.
Yes.
Really quick, there's B-roll footage on YouTube from this movie, and I recommend anybody just go on YouTube and type in Civil War B-roll, because you get to see the actual stunts being done and like some of the explosions happening. You can see how much was actually practical. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's the actors doing actually a lot of their own work, and then sometimes it's obviously like Scarlett Johansson's like amazing stunt woman, you know, kicking her way up a person to like snap his neck with her light, whatever,
actually doing those flippy things.
Right, exactly. And it's really cool. Like, it made me appreciate the movie even more to see how much was really done practical, and it comes across in the movie, obviously.
Yeah,
I think all of that really works for me. The airport fight sequence is obviously like, so much of that couldn't be practical.
Of course.
I agree with you, Alex, that it's at that point where you're just like, this is awesome. But because there's so many characters, you're not really able to track with them as emotionally as you are. So mm-hmm. for me, like, I enjoy watching the airport fight sequence, but it doesn't pack the same emotional punch as the last sequence where Cap and Tony are fighting each other, because I understand what that's about.
Right.
It's about, he killed my mom, you were my friend. And that's why I like this movie among a lot of the other movies in the MCU, because the villain's plan is just to get even with these people, or like make them hurt emotionally in the same way that they hurt him. Like, I really, really like Zemo's whole like master plan. It's not about, he knows he can't take down the Avengers. He knows that, like, yeah, there's going to be no ultimate victory for him. It's just this wounded person who's trying to wound other human beings. I love that as a choice in the entire approach to this movie.
Well, yeah, they talk. So I was thinking about this, and like, people that hate The Last Jedi must also hate this movie, because this movie subverts expectations like crazy.
It
does. That's like the whole thing of this movie, is like subverting what a superhero movie is and what mm-hmm. you expect the third act of a superhero movie to be. Like, thematically, they're dealing with that with the Accords, and look at all the destruction that happens when you guys are saving the world. You're also killing all these people. Mm-hmm. And so the third act of this isn't that. It's an internal conflict.
Yes.
And so I feel like this is a really great example of kind of using, you know, at this point, this was, I don't know what number, but we'd seen a lot of superhero movies at this point. And I think that's the other thing that's kind of interesting and noteworthy about this film is that it is starting to become self-referential in a meta way, as well as within the universe. And sort of like, we know what a superhero movie is. We know what you're expecting. You're expecting them to get to this Siberian compound, and all these other people are going to be super soldiers, and Cap and Iron Man are going to unite and fight it together. But instead, they're all dead. And it's this emotional reveal that makes it a character twist and then leads to like the most brutal fight to that point.
Yeah.
Like when Bucky like jams his like hand into Tony's chest, like I feel that. Like I don't even know what I'm feeling, but I feel it.
It's and so then Cap's just like slamming the shield down in Tony's shit. Like you really get a sense like he's going to kill him. Yeah.
Well, and right. that moment where Tony, where he rips like half of his mask off and he's been punching him, you know, in the face, and then his mask is gone. Tony throws his hands up over his face because he's
expecting
like, exactly. And then of course the shield comes down right on his chest. But again, that moment of just fear, like this person that I love and trust is going to actually kill me right now, is visible in the performance, but it's also just like a really visceral reaction that you get when you watch it.
And it comes after Tony kicking Cap's ass like no one has ever done before, and we see him bleeding, which like basically never happens. So it's all very visceral.
I think the thing that is really tricky, and I think this movie balances it really well, is like ever since the first Avengers movie, because I know like one of the biggest things in comics is like, what if Wolverine fought Spider-Man or whatever? Like it's always just like, what if these two characters fought? And the first Avengers movie, you have that like Cap versus Thor versus Iron Man fight. And then of course, you can always just unleash Hulk and have him have to fight each other. And then this movie, the entire movie is centered around the Avengers fighting each other. But I think
that kind of like stoner what if question, you know? Right. But what if?
Right. But I think that the problem, especially with the airport battle, which, you know, I think the airport battle is fun, but there is a sort of lack of stakes to it, where other than T'Challa, who's like genuinely there to basically kill Bucky, like everybody is there to be like, hey, we're still friends, like we're gonna fight, but like let's just try to win and not actually hurt each other.
Right.
That's really tricky, because then you're like, okay, but I'm just watching eye candy, and that's fine. It's really good eye candy. But then I think what it does next is having Rhodey basically almost die, because then it's like, okay, there are real consequences to this. And then of course that brings us into the final showdown, where you genuinely have characters who are certainly considering actually killing each other. And I think that it's unfortunate that like you can't always have your cake and eat it too, in terms of like, we want these characters to fight each other, but we also like them and we don't want anybody to die. So it's like they all have to like fight happily, fight in a friendly way.
Why did Rhodey have to live after all? Like, because I think that was a moment where it's like, oh, wow, they're going to kill like somebody close to Tony. This is a big deal. That would actually like kind of change the game. Mm-hmm. But it was a kind of a weird cop out where it's like he's kind of pretend dead. And
it was kind of like a Chewbacca on the ship.
Right. Because that is not as big of a deal as Bucky like literally killing Tony's parents. You know, I think that is a much higher reason to get into that. But I think, like I said,
that's a backstory thing. That's not like an in the movie. Cause I guess like, I think if an airport fight began as we're all friends still kind of, but we're going to try to bring you in, and so we have to fight a little bit. If that ended with tragedy, that would be an interesting twist on that fight.
I don't know. I think this was the right call, because you don't want Rhodey, if Rhodey dies right there, which I agree would pack a huge emotional punch. But if you have that, then what Brian is saying, and I agree, it takes away the sort of like long-term, sort of much bigger overarching like ideological conflict that Cap and Tony really can't resolve, right? It's not about, I mean, it's not really about the Accords. It's not really about any one thing. It's more about this like overarching worldview that Tony and Cap have that brings them into conflict. And you don't want it to be about one death like Rhodey's, even though that would be a huge like deal. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was the right decision to have Rhodey live through it. But the consequences to me still feel real. Like when I see Rhodey walking at the end of this movie, you know, using his like magical Iron Man legs that Iron Man gives him, but then he falls down. Like I see that in recovery, and it's like, those are serious consequences. He's paralyzed, basically. And so I do think that it was the right scale of stakes to sort of bring in at the end of that airport fight scene.
I think I agree with both sides, where I feel like I wanted him to actually be dead, because when they reveal he's alive, I was like, oh, okay, well, he's okay, he's like fine, basically. But I also do think that having him die as a consequence makes the whole thing more unforgivable.
Right. And I feel like you don't come back from it ever.
Yeah.
Right.
So I can kind of see both sides to that.
On the same note, quite literally, because I woke up and I found that I had written this note on my phone in the middle of the night.
I hope it's worded in a ridiculous way.
It is readable. It says, "The brief nature of film demands quick resolution and therefore short-term consequences, if any. The power of longer form storytelling is to depict real consequences and provide a catharsis for all of us who have experienced them."
We need to get Dream Trisha on the podcast.
But yeah, it is the thing of like, you're much more, Alex, you're much more of a TV person than I am. I rarely watch like 5 seasons of a TV show from start to finish. But that's where the Infinity Saga for me crosses into that long form storytelling, where we start to see long term consequences. And so when I was going back to rewatch this, I watched all of the Iron Man movies, all of the Captain America movies, and then all of the Avengers movies. And the ongoing fallout from Civil War, as it like bleeds into the second half of this series, is really palpable. And I like all of the longer term consequences that we get, as well as the consequence of events that happened early in Iron Man and early in. So like, it is in this movie where we realize Tony and Pepper are no longer together. Like, I like that as a consequence of like, he is Iron Man. He made that decision and that cost him something. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the MCU succeeds so well, where a lot of other people who are trying to do this kind of haven't figured that out.
Yeah. And that has a nice thematic tie to it, too, which is like there was a consequence of something. And now a person and I are not actually, you know, not that they're not on speaking terms necessarily, but they're not together. And that's what this movie is. And I do like that the movie ends on this sort of positive note where Tony gets the letter from Steve, who says, like, look, I know we're maybe not agreeing right now, but I'll be there for you if I need to be there for you. But then they basically don't have them reconnect for two movie, you know, for several movies.
And like 5 years at least has passed by the time they do reconnect in Endgame, which I feel like is another thing this creative team leans on in an interesting way. Like, I think they use the passage of time to their advantage and like push, like, this is how much people have changed since like you last saw them. And it's like just, I think it's usually just in the right zone of, oh, I can believe that that's kind of where we're at. Like, I can more or less believe that Vision has a crush on Wanda now. Like, sure. Like,
I like Wanda and Vision. I like it.
I liked it more this time. The scene where they're
cooking.
Yeah, they're cooking. Vision's trying to make paprika. Like, it's
is that paprikash? Is there too much pepper on your paprika?
I think of that every time.
Oh, that's so funny. But yeah, it's like watching it from like a screenwriting lens. Like, it is goofy just because, like, who are these people? What is happening? Like,
yeah. She's an actual robot.
Right.
Right. A robot that's an AI that, like, wait, what?
You can go through walls.
But I feel like that scene is, like, such an efficient scene. Like, it sets up,
it
like, their feelings and also that she's trapped. And it's all, like, self-contained in such a, like, nice little package that it's just a really impressive feat of writing. And I feel like overall, that's the thing I'm kind of continually impressed by, is like the way they manage tone and pacing across this movie, and then especially Infinity War and Endgame. I feel like they really nail it.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing that Marcus and McFeely do, they talked about on that podcast that I mentioned, is they said like they want to make some of the lesser thought of movies feel a little more important in hindsight. So that's why you have Age of Ultron is sort of like the impetus for Tony's storyline in Civil War. And then in Endgame, Thor is going back to like Dark World territory and that kind of thing. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, if it feels too obvious, like it feels like you're forcing it, then that's not good, obviously. But I do think it's really interesting then that the idea is you go back and let's say you rewatch the entire Infinity Saga. Now you're watching the Dark World going like, oh man, like his mom is dying and like that's going to be a huge thing in Endgame and you know, like that kind of thing where you are, or you're watching Age of Ultron and you're like, okay, this is kind of a standalone movie, but when that island falls on it, when that city falls on everyone, like that's going to really cause some backlash to everything. And I think that that's a really interesting thing that I'm sure plenty of TV writers, you know, have thought about plenty, which is like, let's take some things that have been done and like, let's kind of recontextualize them through this new story that we're telling. And I just, it's, you know, really interesting to hear them talk about that.
I thought that was brilliant in Endgame, the way they worked in so much from the entire series. It reminded me of a great series finale for a TV show, you know, because that's always what you want, is you want a little bit of a retrospective and a little bit of a, like, let's go back to the good old days and remember the journey we've been on. And to work that in with the time heist was so brilliant. I mean, once again, I'm like, even since we did that MCU podcast, like Endgame has really grown on me. Like, I think Endgame is really an amazing feat that they pulled off. So I'm all about Endgame. And I think to some of these middle movies, I was just thinking as we've been talking, you know, part of maybe what the problem is that just, yeah, like even watching like the core pillar movies, like watching the Avengers movies and the Iron Man's and Captain America's, you know, I'm invested in Tony Stark. I'm probably invested somewhat in Steve Rogers. But when there's a scene with like Wanda, for example, like I saw Age of Ultron like once or twice, and like I don't really care about her character or like what's going to happen to her moving forward. And I feel like the Marvel Universe kind of assumes an investment in all the characters so that like it's exciting to get to see how they're advancing in this movie or what their problem is in this movie. And it's in a weird thing where it's like in a TV show that I'm really invested in, like it is exciting to like see, oh my God, I'm so happy that like this episode showed me like the advancement of this character. And in these Marvel movies, I don't have that, you know, across the 20 characters or whatever. It's like I care about Iron Man, I care about Captain America, but like I don't really know what I feel about Wanda and Vision, and don't really have an investment in the relationship, or like don't even know what her power is really. Like I forgot. Ultimately, my point was that if you are somebody who has watched every single movie, if you're somebody who has read the comics, who's invested in these characters outside of the world of these core pillar movies, then I can understand like why it's exciting to watch these side stories advance, you know, even if within this movie they don't seem to have a whole lot of like relevance. So I think that's I'm trying to square the bridge between why I love long form storytelling in television so much and why it's not working for me so much in these Marvel movies. Cause I feel like I've done the homework to see that like the important Marvel movies, and it's still doesn't function for me like a good, like my favorite TV shows do. And I'm trying to figure out why.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts here. First of all, the challenge of large ensemble storytelling is that you simply are going to have some characters you don't get to spend as much time with. And that's just what ensemble storytelling is, unfortunately. Now, if you're doing that in a standalone movie, which this jumps to mind, like the Independence Day podcast that we did with Lindsay Ellis, we were talking about this. And it's like, that's the thing. You have a standalone movie, you have like 20 characters. So they each only get these tiny little moments. If you expand that out into something as big as the Infinity Saga, they're going to have more moments. But unfortunately, you're still operating in this space of we're tracking more with certain characters than we are with others. And that's kind of the nature of the beast. Now, I will say, to the credit of all of the MCU writers, there's a lot of communication going on between these films. So you have the core six Avengers, you know, who kind of all get their own movies, or will. I truly cannot with Black Widow. We'll have to talk about it at some point and just how dirty the MCU has done her from top to bottom. It's infuriating. But you have these core characters, and the MCU has taken care to spend time with them, and even people like Ant-Man and some of these other characters. And I actually think, and we can circle back to this, but I think that this is a brilliant introduction of the new version of Spider-Man. I think it's great. It's a really, really smart move to bring him in. And Black Panther, right? Those two characters who are going to have their own trilogies are introduced in this movie, and they're really well done. So I think that's part of the nature of the beast. I also think, though, that action storytelling is like ramps up the challenge. So if you're thinking of something, which, you know, Independence Day is sort of in that space as well, but if you're thinking of like another classic ensemble movie that has a ton of characters, I don't know, Brian, help me out, something here. That
Fellowship of the Ring.
Ocean's 11.
Neither one of you is Brian.
But they both had good answers.
Okay, sure. But action storytelling amplifies all of this because the needs to satisfy the needs of the action genre, you end up having to sort of force characters into like, yeah, physical altercations and physical peril in a way that you don't have to do in a drama. And so it's not two characters talking over coffee about what they really feel about each other. It has to be people throwing punches or chasing each other in cars or on motorcycles or whatever it is. And I think that this entire conversation to me is explaining to me why I love really good action screenwriting. It's when we are able, we're given enough character, like motivation, clean and understandable, sympathetic, rich, thematic, and then we're given really amazing action sequences. It's that much harder to do. And I think that even if you don't like Wanda, what Michael was saying about this, the scene between her and Vision is incredibly efficient, clean, well set up, like emotional stakes. It's in there. I mean, action movies get snubbed a lot of the time in terms of like serious storytelling, quote unquote. But I would argue that they're harder to do really well than some other kinds of writing. And so I really, really respect this movie for that reason.
And also to the MCU's credit, I find it really emotionally powerful when she's having to sacrifice Vision in Infinity War, you know? So there is a lot of setup here that doesn't necessarily get paid off within this movie, which I then appreciate later in the payoff movies.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's that weird thing of like, I really enjoy the payoff for all this. And it's kind of like, I'm like weird. Like I get worn out on the journey there. It's almost kind of my experience.
Well, I think something interesting that differentiates television from film is I find there's this weird thing where it's like it's easier to watch 10 hour long episodes of a TV show sometimes than it is to watch two or three movies.
Right.
Because like watching a movie can, it depends on the movie, obviously, but like watching a movie, it's sort of like, okay, I have to like learn who these characters are. And then they're going on this full journey. And then like, I'm like tense. And then like, finally it's done. And then now a resolution. And now I have to do all that again. Where usually like a season of television that happens over the course of 10 hours or something.
See, this is not true for me because I think I bump on like the engine of TV where I feel like stories naturally have ending points and TV like denies us them for just the sake of what it is.
Sure, definitely. And plenty of shows clearly did not know what to do with seasons three through whatever, you know. But I think that a lot of times with the show, you are sort of waiting for that resolution and you're excited to watch the next episode because it's building towards this thing that you're waiting for. Whereas obviously that's not the case in a 23 film series where half the characters don't show up in half of the movies. Like it's, you don't get to see what happens to Iron Man next when you watch Ant-Man and the Wasp. Like you have to wait until the next movie to get there. Reading the Game of Thrones books is actually like that because it will be like an Arya chapter and then a Jon chapter and then a Sansa chapter. And then you don't get another Arya chapter until 100 pages later. So it doesn't have the sort of, you know, Dan Brown, like every chapter is a cliffhanger. You're like, I got to read the next one. It's this sort of like, oh, I'm so excited to see what happens to Arya next. I have to wait 100 pages for that. Some people are better readers than I am, and they'll just read 100 more pages before they go to bed. I'm like, nope, I'm going to set the book down, and then eventually I'll get to find that out. So, Alex, I get that it's like, it's not the same thing as watching, like watch The Office, the first three seasons of The Office, and like every single episode you're going like, ooh, there was some Jim and Pam something going on. Like, I need to watch the next episode to see if like that, when is that going to resolve? And even when you know it's not happening till when it happens. You're like, I know, but I want to keep watching because I want to get to that point. You're sort of waiting to get to that point. That's not how the MCU operates. It's how maybe seven films of the series operate if you only look at those seven films, but that's not what it is. It's if we look at it as a movie, it's a movie with like an A, B, C, D, you know, down to like M plot, you know, where like the plots don't, it's not like every single movie is tying to this greater thing. But they do tie in the sense that like the characters show up in each other's movies and they all are interconnected in some way.
Yep.
I think that's a really interesting thing that you raised, this idea of like story inertia almost. And I think kind of encapsulated for me how I feel why it's easier for me to watch TV. Like it's hard for me to start a TV show because I'm like, oh my God,
for the same reasons we talked about.
Like,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it's okay, we're gonna meet all the people and like, okay, da 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 da. But once you've done that, there is this kind of inertia that you can ride. And in a narrative film, each film has to start from zero, get you up to speed and take you all the way through. And so it feels like more effort is required on the part of the viewer, and that is often rewarded. Like I don't think one is better than the other. I think that's just kind of an inherent difference between them. And I think it is interesting that the MCU kind of makes that morph and happens with Civil War, where they're like, we're not going to like worry about bringing you from zero anymore. We're just going to assume you're already at speed. And that leaves people behind, but also lets them do something different with the rest of it. And so I think it's just a really interesting thing to think about as like storytellers and as we're examining the forms that stories come in now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what you asked in our previous podcast about this, which is, are these movies? And I do agree with you, Alex, as you guys were both saying earlier, you and Michael, there's an extent to which Civil War is the crossing of the threshold where these are no longer movies in that same sense. It does become more like a really long, like, form TV show in a way where, you can't track with absolutely everything if you haven't been on this ride for a certain amount of time. I think that that's actually a smart transition on the part of Marvel Studios, right? Like, because with what they're trying to pull off here, it's absolutely not going to work if you're trying to bring in new viewers and hold their hands through all of this. That just doesn't happen at a certain point. But I think that what they're going after, and as we've talked about before, has never been done before. And really, they were trying something new and pushing the boundaries of what are movies? Can we do this? And they've done it spectacularly. And I think that the natural consequence of that is Civil War. There has to be that gear shift at a certain moment.
And I think on a meta level, it signals to the world that like, okay, we're wrapping this up. Like, we get it. We've been doing a lot of these, but like, there's an end point now. So there's this kind of meta thing happening.
Yeah, I think for me, if Civil War was like broken into like 3 45-minute episodes, like a TV show, I might actually like it more. Because I think because it has that episodic nature and because the beginning is not really a beginning and the end is not really an end, like, I think if I could like watch it in chunks, like I could get my mind into like a mode of like, I'm enjoying this like ongoing story. But I think because these movies are presented like a year apart from each other, like in theaters, like I haven't watched the previous 6 movies the day before, whatever. Like, I think there's an exhaustion that I feel watching them that I don't feel when watch like binging a Netflix show. And I think that's,
I mean, Civil War is like an exhausting movie. Like, it is, there's a lot going on. And I had that thought watching it this time. Like I said, it's almost like 3 individual stories, or even 4 if you kind of count the, you know, like each act or even like the midpoint. It's just sort of like, oh, there's this thing. And I think it's unfortunate. I'm really curious about the MCU TV version. I forget what it's going to be called, but the Disney Plus, you know, Marvel shows that are coming out, like one of which is Falcon and Winter Soldier.
And WandaVision.
And WandaVision, of course. But that like clearly is going to be a TV show.
Yeah, yeah.
But like if you have Falcon and Winter Soldier, if you have like a Loki one and all this stuff, I'm like really curious, like, can we get closer to bridging that gap between, you know, like someone said, oh, The Irishman, I liked it, but why wasn't it just a 4-part series? And it's like, because then it would be a TV show and not a movie. And that affects how people think about things. Even if The Irishman was literally the exact same thing split into 4 parts, people would be like, oh, it's a show. It's a series. It's a whatever. It's not a movie. Like,
it's a limited series.
Yeah. It's a limited series. Yeah. But, and we're definitely bridging that gap. But I just think it's weird that we that we feel so much differently about, like, something being a movie versus being a, you know, like a limited series.
I think when I talk about the exhaustion, it's like it's watching like a really epic 2-hour, is it 40-minute movie? The fact that for me, it doesn't deliver like a complete movie catharsis, like, conclusion at the end of that, like, really epic journey. Like, it feels like the whole thing is middle in a lot of ways to me. That's maybe where the exhaustion comes from, because it's like you're putting in the, like, Lord of the Rings scale, like, investment. It also might just be I just don't care about the Marvel Universe. Yeah, and that might just be it. You know,
I think
I'm trying to figure out why I don't like these movies.
There's, like, I think there's differences in taste happening, but as you were saying, Brian, there's differences in expectations of what a movie is. And that's why I hated Lord of the Rings. When I watched the first Fellowship of the Ring and it just ended, and I was like, wait, what? I was so upset, because it's playing with the form, and that
right.
You have certain expectations. And so I think it only makes sense that it's going to be messy when we're playing with that, and people are going to react differently. And the one thing we can all agree on is that Spider-Man is great, and I love the way he's introduced. And I just want to, there's a moment in the scene that when I was listening to the commentary, they talked about that I just wanted to say, because it's
yes.
really funny.
Yes.
Is the, you know, it was like Tom Holland's, like, you know, first day on set, and he's like this kid, and he's acting with Robert Downey Jr. in this new Avengers movie. Uh-huh. Like, it's a big deal, and he was super nervous. And apparently Robert Downey Jr. was just super accommodating and, like, helping him, like, craft this star-making performance, basically. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment where Tony gets up to go sit next to him on the bed.
Uh-huh.
And Tony has the line, "I'm going to sit here, so you move the leg."
Right.
That was an improvise
nice.
Because Tom Holland forgot the blocking of the scene.
Right.
And Robert Downey Jr. just rolls with it and makes it that much better of, like, it's
I
just
love
an amazing
moment.
Yeah.
Right. It's so great.
That whole scene, I mean, everything about the way that Spider-Man is introduced in this, where it's like it's concealed from us for a little while who he is and, like, what's going on. The new take on Aunt May is just 180 degrees from every version of Aunt May we've ever seen.
Right.
But then, yeah, where Tony's, like, poking around his bedroom and, like, finds his stuff, where he's like, what is this? What is that? This is you, isn't it? It's really, really, like, we figure it out really quickly, but they spend enough time in that scene. And it's almost jarring with the rest of the movie how much time we spend in that scene, because it's a longer scene than, like, any other scene of just dialogue that exists mm-hmm. in the movie. There's not that much dialogue anywhere else in the entire movie of two people talking to each other, but they really spend the time with it, and it pays off so well when we get to, like, more and more into the character relationship between Iron Man and Spider-Man. And so it feels almost like it takes you out of the rhythm of the movie. But it's smart to do this here so that they can kind
right.
of, like, get into it more quickly when you get into Spider-Man Homecoming.
And I just feel like they navigate all the meta things also so elegantly.
Well,
like,
yes. mm-hmm.
we've seen, like, we know Spider-Man's backstory. We've seen it 400 times. Like, just skip to, like, the most fun parts. Give us hints of the things we already know to just be like, okay, yeah, that's what it is. And now this is our new Spider-Man, and this is how he's coming into the movie. And it was, I remember being, like, tense once I realized what they were doing, of like, oh God, they could really screw this up. And then by the end of that scene, just being like, I'm so happy. I love this new Spider-Man.
Yeah. And the nervousness is adorable.
Right.
It works yeah. so well.
Yeah. So. A lot of that was real, apparently. And
right.
channeled nicely.
Which is a nice, yeah, the casting. Well done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, Tom Holland can do this, but Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, you ask them to play Sherlock and Watson, they knock it out of the park. You ask them to play Bilbo and both antagonists in the Hobbit films, and they're the best part of this, like, lame trilogy. You ask them to have believable American accents in a Marvel movie.
No, they cannot. No, sir. God bless them.
Tom Holland, on the other hand, excellent.
Right.
Yeah.
It did, like, take me a minute. Like, when Martin Freeman showed up, I was like, why is he talking funny? Like, what is this character choice that's happening?
Is this Fargo season one?
Yeah. I love Tom Holland's background in dance as well, because it works so well for the character.
Mm.
Like, the way that he moves, it just makes so much sense. That's how Spider-Man could and should move. But it's because of Tom Holland and, like, all the dance that he comes from. And
You've seen him performing Umbrella.
Surely. One of the greatest videos of all time.
Of all time. Yes. Awesome.
One thing that I know about you, listener, is that you are smart and cool and amazing.
Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome, Brian.
Oh, you weren't. I'm sorry.
I mean, you're
no, it's fine. It's fine. I get it.
We were listening too. We count.
Yes, you are, Michael. Smart and cool and amazing. And I know our listeners are too, because I've talked to a lot of them on Twitter and on Patreon, and they are great to talk to. They have fascinating opinions about movies. But I'm sure that our listeners also have friends and kindred spirits who are obsessed with movies. We would love to meet them too. So you should tell that person about Beyond the Screenplay and bring them into our community, because we would love to get to know you all better.
Should we start a cult?
Yeah. But a fun kind of cult where we all get rich. Not the right kind where we all die.
Yeah. Those are the best kind. To quickly wrap up, I want to ask everyone, which side of the Civil War would you be on?
Ooh.
Are you Team Cap or are you Team Iron Man? Brian, do you want to start us off?
I don't know. I feel like there's the Bucky problem, which is like,
it's real.
In theory, I would be on the side that is like, I don't want to be kept in check by authority. I'm not going to sign this thing that, you know, like, I think just based on that alone, I would be Team Cap. But I feel like in terms of who the actual characters are on each side and you know, which side I would, which gang I would rather hang out with, I'd probably be Team Tony. Yeah.
Yeah. When they do the, like, the two shots of, like, the two sides of the airport, I'm always like, Tony has the cooler team.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's be honest here. Alex, what about you?
Yeah, I think the same as Brian for pretty much the same reasons. Just the Bucky problem. And I would probably be on the side of, I'm a little nervous about what this group of enhanced humans could potentially do. And maybe it's good for the world to have some say over our actions.
Okay. So we're leaning toward oversight slightly here and then right on the team. All right. Trisha.
Do they need anyone to just hang out with Aunt May?
Legit.
They have plenty of people ready for that.
I'm Team Tony, mostly because Black Widow's journey in this is, or like her logic through all of this, I really relate to, which is like, I have to make a strategic decision here, and it's probably better to do that inside the system than, or like, will be more effective to do that inside the system. Like, I'm not going to be able to take it down from the outside. Probably that's not going to go the way that I want. So kind of this like opportunistic, like, I might as well do this now, potentially walk it back later, stay on the good side of everybody if I can in the meantime. You kind of have to be a little bit, yeah, strategic about it. But then she lets Cap and Bucky go, which is like, you know, that's not going to go well for you.
Right.
But it is, they are sympathetic. Basically, I'm Black Widow.
I like that. I feel like this was like when I became a big fan of her also. Like, I feel like she gets to do really
well. They finally
things.
Gave her something to do, didn't
something
they?
Something to do.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. I also love that, like, after everyone's arrested, they're taken to like Azkaban in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
Like,
but, okay. It really is.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I am also Team Tony, which probably doesn't surprise anybody. Just like, it's the cooler team. And like, yeah, rules are important, everybody. Like, there needs to be some structure and order to everything. Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take away from Captain America Civil War. Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I think it's interesting because when you think about this movie, you think about it's this sort of two sides movie, even though it does have this clear protagonist in Steve, and it does have this antagonist who isn't Tony, you know, Daniel Brühl with the most punchable face in Hollywood.
I like his face.
It's punchable, though. Actually, sorry, Kyle Chandler, then Daniel Brühl.
How dare.
Nothing okay. against them as actors. Nothing even against them as, you know, in their looks. Just I want to punch them.
wow. All right.
That's all.
They, I have know, different we, feelings, but that's
we can
okay.
be friends. We, you know. but obviously the main focus of the movie is Steve and Tony's conflict. And I think what's cool and what this movie really shows is that you don't need to determine a protagonist and an antagonist, even though this is Captain America Civil War. It doesn't feel like it's, oh, here's the good guy and here's the bad guy. Here's the guy we're supposed to be with. Here's the other guy. It's both characters are operating on a philosophy that you can understand and you can mm-hmm. get behind. And you don't need to necessarily be rooting for anybody. Like, I think about something like Marriage Story, where I'm not actually rooting for anybody. I'm just watching these two characters. I'm hoping there's going to be some satisfying resolution, but I get where they're both coming from and I'm just following them along. And maybe sometimes you agree with one character more than another, but I do like that you can have these two characters who you're not asking the audience to agree with one more than the other. You're just asking the audience to go along with the ride, basically, mm-hmm. as opposed to something like Black Panther, where you have Killmonger, where it's like, it's a sympathetic antagonist. You understand why he's doing what he's doing, but you're not being asked to agree with it or think it's a good idea. And I just like that this movie really is a good example of how you don't need to determine who is right and who is wrong in your movie. You know, like we talked about, Trisha, with Jurassic Park, with, you know, with Hammond and Grant, where it's like, it's not about, oh, he's right and he's wrong. It's about, no, these characters are arguing about this idea, and we can think about who we are on board with, but these screenwriters are not asking you to make a right. choice.
Yeah, for sure. Alex?
So I feel like this has been a slightly fraught conversation about the Marvel series. But yeah, I think what I've said before earlier on this podcast was that I am so impressed with the payoff for all this. Like the fact that Endgame sticks the landing that well does give me a deeper appreciation of the entire series. And editing this video, helping to write this video about the arcs of the two main characters was also kind of revelatory for me, of like, wow, this is a really epic thing they constructed that they managed to shepherd all the way through to the end. So I think that's really what I just am most impressed by. Basically, I'm impressed with the overall feat of this whole thing. And even if I don't love all the individual movies in this giant thing, there's probably a reason why I loved Endgame. And part of it is the setup, you know? So I think I have to respect that and admire what they accomplished.
Hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. Trisha?
I really love the design of Helmut Zemo here. I think it's a really smart approach to writing the villain character. It strips back the genre imperatives here. You're writing a huge action superhero movie. So if you are Marcus and McFeely and you sit down to do that, instead of starting with, okay, so how's the world going to get in jeopardy this time? You go back to the characters, you go back to the situations, you go back to sort of the themes that are embedded in here. What does it really mean to have enhanced people in the world? What is the cost? And so you're asking something serious and grounded without necessarily planning, and maybe they were, you know, doing all of this at the same time, but without necessarily planning, okay, and then this is how it's going to arrive in this climactic fight. This is how it's going to, like, we're going to, you know, smash up some cars and we're going to do whatever it is. If you strip down the genre to be the story about the characters, you often arrive at a more interesting design for an antagonist. And I think that's exactly what we have here in Zemo. And that's one of the biggest reasons that I really love this movie, is because you have somebody who is just a wounded person with a real, compelling, believable wound. When Zemo is sitting there listening to the voicemail that he has saved, the last voicemail that he got from his wife and his son, it doesn't just make him a sympathetic villain. It makes him an understandable human. And at the end of this movie, he puts a gun under his chin and tries to kill himself. He's not trying to win.
Mm-hmm.
That's a more interesting villain than any other one in this series, I would think. Like, I mean, Thanos is great. And, you know, there's a rich thematic argument that's being had in Endgame and in Infinity War. But Zemo here is a person in a way that a lot of these other villains kind of don't manage to be. And so I really, really like the design of him here. And I think that there are a myriad of lessons that we can take away from that. But I just want to, yeah, I really, really like this as a genre writer myself. I think that no matter what genre you're operating in, if you can find the humanity of somebody, that's the way you succeed.
Yeah. And I do feel like this is kind of where they started to, in general, put a few more interesting antagonists into the MCU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, not 100%, but I feel like they started to play around with it a little bit. And I think the success of this character probably pushed them toward that.
Yeah, and thematically too, this movie is in a lot of ways about grief and how people deal with having lost something or lost someone. And so again, the design of the antagonist is born out of this sort of thematic thing. We see Tony grieving the loss of his parents. We see Wanda grieving the loss of her brother. We see like all of this grief is sort of baked in here. And so then to have that be the engine that drives the villain here, it's good writing.
Yeah, I think for me, I am blown away by how like the immense juggling, like you were saying, Alex, the feat of all of this and how this creative team, and I think it's probably no accident that it is co-writers and co-directors, because I think you need that many minds to hold all of this, but that these films that they worked on, especially for me, starting with Civil War, like are tonally like pitch perfect, I think, and there are no flaws with any of it. And I think at times that can make it feel a little too clean and safe, but I think at the same time, that's extremely impressive. And then when it lands that much more. And so that's just every time I'm watching it, I'm blown away by like, how did you know that we needed this kind of moment and this mood to have this beat play? And then you like bring up music or this transition, like camera moves this way and like the story beat changes is like all senses in this, the range of tones and emotions and beats and the things that they're asking us to go along with are insane.
Yes.
For all of these movies, but it really works. I can't picture it being done any better, and that's just really impressive. So I think they're movies that I will return to when thinking about that and tonal transitions and how to run the dynamic range of your story without losing the audience.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. What's everyone been watching? Trisha.
I decided to watch a movie directed by Michael Crichton.
What?
He directed...
was directed by Michael Crichton.
Listen, he directed some movies, and one of them is the movie Runaway from 1984, starring Tom Selleck, Cynthia Rhodes, Gene Simmons as the villain, and Kirstie Alley.
Wow.
The plot of this... It was a time. The plot of this movie is basically cops versus robots, and I love it. It is not a good movie, but it's just like a big, stupid action movie from 1984 with really bad like robots in it that are all, they look like they're made of Kinects or like an Erector set kind of thing with like the metal. You know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
With like bolts. Like why do machines have so many bolts in them? And there's like electricity everywhere, like lots of wires. It's great. It's really, really bad. But yeah, if you want to see a movie Michael Crichton directed, you can check out Runaway. It's actually quite watchable. It's quite watchable. It's very tight. It's like 90 minutes long. And Cops versus Robots, you got it. It's great. Right.
He directed Westworld.
Yeah, he did.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought he directed the movie.
Yeah.
And the Great Train Robbery, which, you know, those are both like fairly well thought of movies.
Yeah.
Ish.
And Runaway.
And Runaway.
Awesome. Brian, what have you been watching?
You mentioned, Michael, a few many episodes ago that you watched for the first time the movie What We Do in the Shadows. And I mentioned that I started watching the TV show and then just never finished. And I finally caught up over the past couple weeks, and it is delightful. It's everything. Like, if you're a fan of the movie, you need to watch the show. It takes a second to get into because the first episode is too much just kind of a copy of the movie. Mm-hmm. And then like the second, third episode, you're like, I don't know quite what I'm watching yet. But then once you settle into like the middle of the season, then you're just like, okay, I know what the show is. I know who these characters are. And you can just really settle into it and have fun with it. It actually, like we're talking about with the MCU, it balances the sort of episodic structure with overarching storylines in a nice way, where it's very much by definition a sitcom, where like every episode is like, what if these characters were in a library or whatever? It's like very much like, we are doing this thing this week. But then there are plot points that you're like, oh, that could just be a throwaway thing. And then that plot point ends up coming back and driving the story and everything. So you're not just watching this like total throwaway one-off every week kind of thing. And it is actually like Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement are involved with it. So Taika directed, I think, two episodes and Jemaine co-wrote those episodes. They both show up in a brief point. And there's a bunch of like fun cameos from like Nick Kroll, Haley Joel Osment, Tilda Swinton, Craig Robinson, Beanie Feldstein, Vanessa Bayer, Benedict Wong, and some other people that I won't mention because there's one episode where it's basically like the Vampire Council. And yeah, so it's just like an episode that that's an episode that's directed by Taika and written by Jermaine. And that's just like rife for cameo. And yeah, so nice. Highly recommended.
Awesome. Alex, what have you been watching?
So I don't know if this is allowed because I've been playing it, but I wanted to mention it this week because we're talking about the MCU. So I've been playing God of War, which is a PS4 game. I've been playing a lot of video games lately because we've been all locked in our houses. And I have to say that what I understand for like a lot of people, especially young people, like the Marvel movies feel like and why they're so like renowned and wonderful is how I feel playing this game. Like, I think this game cinematically and just like just viscerally is giving me the experience that I think I'm supposed to be getting when I go to see a modern blockbuster in theaters now. You know, when I go to see kind of a modern superhero blockbuster movie, I know that like there's a lot of craft going on and these epic scenes are like a really amazing feat of, you know, art. And yet I'm at a distance, I'm kind of zoning out, I'm kind of not really with it, I'm kind of just waiting for it to be over sometimes. And in this game, there are a lot of moments where you're not even controlling, you're not playing physically, and you're going through this like thrilling cutscene that is giving me like the childlike, like giddy feelings that I used to get from movies. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. I think I'm starting to get from really blockbuster video games the thing that I used to get from movies and don't really anymore. And so it's a very interesting observation I found. It's like, oh, I can still get this thing, but it seems to be working for me in this interactive format, whereas I'm feeling at a distance and kind of detached in whatever's happening right now with a lot of modern blockbusters.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I feel like there's probably, for me anyway, I think a lot of, you know, the more you study a thing, the less visceral impact it can have on you.
Right. There's a magic. There's a real magic for me playing some of these like AAA games. It's like, I don't understand how you're giving me this experience. It's so amazing. Hmm.
Yeah, I think you can develop a deeper appreciation for things, but there is, I think, for me anyway, less of that because the magic of the trick is gone. You don't get the same wow right. when they pull off a magic trick.
Right.
I just started one episode only of Killing Eve.
Mm. Oh, cool.
Which had been on my list for a while, created by obviously Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and it was delightful. It's, as I mentioned before, there's this almost tension and stress I feel starting a new show because it's like they're gonna show me all these things, I gotta learn all this stuff, there's gonna be all this setup, like okay, I'm here for it, let's try it. And this one was just like a smooth, delightful ride, and I think you can really feel the Phoebe Waller-Bridge tonality coming through and the playfulness of the characters, and it also then lets it do that thing where the comedy kind of lets you forces you to let your guard down so that then when impactful things happen, it like really hits you because you're like, oh wow, they went there, but it still feels contained and reasonable to put all that in the same thing. So I've only watched the first episode, but I'm very excited to continue it. It's one of the few things that I've seen and it like stays in the back of my mind of like, wait, but I want to go like watch like what's next. It's also dealing with sociopaths, which, you know,
your favorite thing.
About,
yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, this has been our conversation on Captain America Civil War. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to the patrons for supporting the show and making it possible. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.